high-resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
Welcome to This Week in Retro for the week of October 26th, 2020. Coming up on today's show...
How many more minis?
The Atari Hotel Chain.
A hole-in-one for the C64.
Arcade Dreams Documentary Kickstarter. All this and more on This Week in Retro.
Up-to-date news
for out-of-date tech.
John, I don't know about you, but I'm starting to get mini console fatigue right now. A week doesn't seem to go by when we're not talking about the latest miniaturization of a system or a console today. And, this episode is no different. So tell me, John, before I tell you what this week's mini announcement is there a mini system that doesn't exist yet that you'd like to see made?
Oh, yeah. I mean... Listen, Neil, I love anything small, anything miniature. I love stuff like model railroads, the Lego architecture series. I've got a whole bunch of those little video game dioramas that people make. There's nothing small that I'm not into. What I don't care about with these mini consoles is functionality. You know, I'd rather see like little Funko. Do they have Funko Pop figures in England, Neil?
Yeah, Funko Pops. And there are these ducks that you can buy that are like Street Fighter ducks and all of those kind of things.
Right.
Tubs, they're called. There's all that stuff. I'm not into any of that stuff, I've got to say.
I will say that the Funko Pop craze is probably jumped the shark. But what I'd like to see is something about that size. You know, make me a console with a matching TV or a mini computer with a matching monitor that when you switch them on, you know, have a working screen, but play a demo reel or something like that. I'd rather see that and be able to line a bunch of those up on my shelf than a half size or a three quarter size working unit that I just use as a display piece anyway. You know, I've got real hardware. I've got the real stuff. I've got emulators for when I don't feel like taking out the real stuff. I don't need any more ways to play my favorite games. What do you think, Neil?
Yeah, I like that idea, actually, how you've just explained it there. I would love lots of mini arcades that are just playing the attract screen with your sounds.
Yeah, yeah.
Turn them all on and close your eyes and pretend you're in an arcade. That would work for me. What I've got a yearning for at the moment, though, is a mini pinball table. To go alongside my mini gauntlet cabinet that I've got. And that, I'm not talking about a physical, you know, a real table with balls pinging around. I mean a mini digital pinball table, so I can swap out the tables that I play on. You could have a little vertical screen at the back with the art that swaps around and the scoreboard and all of that stuff. I think there'd be a big market for that. I mean, I've never really been into pinball, but I've just got a yearning to have that, have that kind of system to be able to experiment and get to know all of the different classic tables.
You know, I'm very surprised that that has not made an appearance yet with all the mini crazes that are going on right now, because pinball does emulate so well on small screens. You know, people have built virtual pinball tables and there are even some commercially available ones that just swap out the real play fields for, you know, basically TV screens, and they do pretty well. So, you know, you may be on something there.
Yeah, the software exists. So just scale that down. Yeah, I think the key is just trying to get some kind of sense of depth on a pinball table, because you're using a flat monitor, of course. If you can just sort of drop it down, maybe put some smoky glass over it just to give a little bit of, you know, fool the eye a little bit, I think that would be really good. Anyway, that's what we want. And it's none of those things that's been announced this week. It's an announcement by Atari, and it's the Mini Pong Junior. Ooh. Yeah. Does Mini Pong get the nostalgic juices going for you, John?
You know, a few years back, Atari released a coffee table size. Well, it was a coffee table. It was a coffee table size coffee table. Imagine that. This thing had built-in Pong, okay? But instead of a screen, this is kind of the opposite of what we were talking about with the pinball thing. It actually used a real block and real paddles. And this thing was powered by motors and rails and pulleys and magnets. And Neil, if there's anything I'm a bigger fan of than small stuff, it's anything that's mechanically operated, you know, with tons of gears and stuff like that. I love the feeling of knowing that there is a lot of complicated machinery going on behind the scenes that I don't see. So, however, this is not that at all. Unfortunately, this is an LCD screen that plays Pong. Yay. So it doesn't excite me at all. You do get a paddle controller, you know, a rotating knob. So you don't have like, you know, the only thing that can make this work is or worse is if it was some sort of a D-pad or something like that. So at least you do have the accurate, you know, knob of control like the original Pong had. But I'm just guessing from your lead in, this isn't doing a lot for you either, is it?
It's not. It really isn't. And you're making a really good effort to try and find some positives in it there. But I will say this for Pong, you know, it's head-to-head gaming in one of its purest forms. It is a super simple battle of reflexes, essentially, mm-hmm. which can be good fun in short bursts. And it's always best played against another human rather than the AI. And this thing does have different difficulty levels of AI to play against. But yeah, I'm struggling to find the positives as well. What we do know about this thing is that it's only 30 centimeters long. It's got a 7.9-inch LCD panel. You've got the dial, as you mentioned, at either end of the screen for each player and a button to serve. You can charge it via USB and then take it with the battery charged and play Pong on the move. So, you know, it's Pong for people with a busy lifestyle, John.
That is quite the sales pitch.
The price hasn't been revealed yet. It is due out in time for Christmas. And looking at a photo of it, it looks just like one of those old LCD tabletop games from the 70s or 80s. So it has got that kind of cheap plasticky look about it. Looks like a tablet, really, dropped into a plastic box mm-hmm. with two dials. That's how I describe it. That's fine by me if the price reflects that, but something tells me that might not be the case. So we need to look out for the price announcement. I honestly won't be watching it too closely. Maybe if it had a selection of breakout games thrown in too, that would be more interesting, but this is just pure Pong. If it comes in under £20, sure, fine. But I've got a feeling it's going to be higher than that. What would your upper price limit be on this one, John?
I think $20 is the upper limit. I don't know if you got this in the UK, but here in the States, we had a bunch of releases here recently playing on the nostalgic feelings of people our age. There was a standalone Oregon Trail game.
Oh, yes.
That basically, you know, it took all of the keyboard commands and mapped them to individual buttons and labeled the buttons. You know, and it came in an attractive looking case. I think it was about $15. And of course, we've seen all of the, you know, handheld style arcade machines of various quality being marketed, and even going earlier, the old LCD powered Mattel baseball and football games, which are about as, you know, philistine as you can get in terms of portable gaming. But these things have nostalgic, you know, they trigger nostalgia in fans of a certain age, and they've been re-released as well. So I think there's probably a market for this. You've just got to put it right in that stocking stuffer category.
Yeah. How long before companies like Tomy start actually making one-to-one reproductions of those original plasticky tabletop LCD games? You know, I'm sure that will come before long. And you've got the Dying of Dysentery on the move with portable Oregon Trail for, for busy lifestyles. Well, Pong fans, keep an eye out on Atari.com for this release. And let us know on the This Week in Retro subreddit if you'll be buying one of these.
Neil, when you think of fine hotels, what comes to mind? Maybe someplace like the Ritz-Carlton, the Oriental, or the Park Hyatt? Well, soon we may be adding Atari to that list. Paul, a.k.a. Hermsky, has submitted a story from PC Gamer that contains a concept rendering of an Atari-themed gaming hotel, and this thing looks like something straight out of a YouTube thumbnail of a 10-hour Vaporwave compilation. You've got neon out the wazoo. You've got classic Atari 2600 box art lining the promenade. Now, Neil, before we get into the specifics of an Atari-themed hotel, in the interest of equal time, what classic British computer do you think should get the hotel treatment?
Oh, it's a good question. If my Atari hotel room doesn't have a complimentary mini Pong console, by the way, I'll be disappointed. But if we did have a British equivalent, then I would have to go with the Amstrad Hotel. My first machine was an Amstrad CPC, so I've got lots of nostalgia for it. And Amstrad can actually provide everything we need. We can have the cheap Amstrad Hi-Fi, which was designed to look like separates of a stack system, but is actually just one lump of molded plastic.
Classic.
We'll have the Amstrad emailer phone to send out emails and get ourselves on Instagram and share pictures. Did you know you can still buy an Amstrad TV, by the way? The Amstrad brand seems to live on in India. So somebody's obviously paid up for the rights to use the name. There are 4K Amstrad smart TVs that you can still buy there. Washing machines, dishwashers, all sorts. So we could pair up an 8-bit Amstrad CPC Micro with a new Amstrad 4K TV. There we go. I would stay in that Amstrad hotel. Speaking of which, by the way, with Amstrad, this was a company that, as I described there with the hi-fi, tried to take something premium, make it look premium, but actually, you know, make it really cheap. Did you have an equivalent company in America that did that?
Oh, I think that's every company in America. We are dressing things up to the nines to hide the fact that this was made by, you know, a sweatshop worker in Pakistan. Yeah. You know, it's really unfortunate. Whenever you buy, let me share a story. I went to buy a new chair for my podcasting desk. And I was looking around in the used furniture room, and I found it was built like a tank. I mean, the legs and the base are made out of cast iron, and you know, it felt so comfortable. And I asked the guy running the store. I said, "Hey, you know, this is a nice chair, but you know, the upholstery is a little bit worn. What if I just want to get a new one that is the same quality?" And he's like, "They just don't make them anymore. There are no chair manufacturers make things to this standard. Even if you spend $1,000 or $2,000, so nothing is built like it used to be, Neil. Nothing."
Yeah. No, it's a sad tale. So, but back to the story. What do you think of this Atari hotel idea, John? Good idea or not for you?
I don't know. When I go to a hotel, unless we're going, you know, unless we're talking about a resort, like some sort of Caribbean resort or something like that, I'm not really there to soak up the atmosphere. You know, I'm there to do other things, to leave the hotel and go out and about. So as long as my room has working AC and is relatively rat-free, I'm pretty content. However, it looks like Atari is kind of going the resort route with this thing. They're planning some related amenities. They're going to have retro arcades, a VR space, some gaming-themed restaurants and bars. Personally, I hope the bar has fake wood grain paneling to match the original 2600. That would be awesome. I'd love that. But, you know, when I hear things like, you know, gaming-themed restaurants and bars, there are so many ways that you can do that poorly. And, you know, a VR space, are we going to be playing Pong in VR, you know, on some grody, you know, headset? They're going to have to prove it to me, Neil. Neil, are there any other amenities that you would think a gaming-themed hotel might be enticing?
Yeah, I'm with you on all the points you've raised there. I think that, for me, a hotel has to be in a good location and it has to be clean, and that's about it. If I'm going on holiday to stay in a hotel, it doesn't really matter above and beyond cleanliness and location. If I was traveling for business, I guess it might be a nice distraction to go and play some video games in the lobby or whatever. But there are two things that stand out as a problem for me with this whole concept of an Atari themed hotel. The first is that surely this is going to be sold as a premium experience. It offers something that other hotels don't. But when you think about a traditional arcade or gaming arena, that's not a premium space. You don't think of the arcade you went to in the 80s or 90s with its sticky carpet and the guy dishing out change from the booth in a string vest. You don't think of that as a classy establishment. So how do you present an experience that reflects the premium price that this hotel will be charging while evoking nostalgia for a distinctly non-premium experience? I'm not making that connection. I don't know how that will work out. The other is the longevity of it. You know, you've mentioned synthwave and, you know, the wood paneling, and no doubt there'll be RGB lighting and all of that stuff. And I love all of that. I love the vaporware look. But this is art, you know, music and art. This evolves. Nothing stands still. And the style of 2020 vaporware art, despite being art that taps into nostalgic themes, will be outdated quickly. Mm-hmm. And so too, yeah, with it, the whole look of the hotel. So if you go all out in that style, it's going to look dated and old pretty quickly, and not in the good dated and old nostalgic way. So I think they need to think really carefully about the aesthetic of it. Yes, go for wood grain and get that Atari logo up on all the walls. But I think subtlety has to be the key to create something that's both classy and doesn't have to be torn down in 2 years because it looks outdated.
I think that if they do it right, they can make these pieces modular enough that they can kind of move along with the trends. You know, eventually the people that care about the 2600 are going to be dead. That's just all there is to it. And they're gonna have to move on up. And that is when they move full force into their JAG themed hotel, Neil. That's what everybody's waiting for, is for the time when people grew up with the JAG to have their own hotel. And if they do it right, they can just basically swap out panels. You know, they can switch out because of all the digital stuff, they can move those things out. And I feel like I said, because of the way that digital signage works these days, you know, a lot of this stuff can just be displayed on LCD monitors. And I'm not saying that that is preferable to having real, you know, wood paneling and things like that. But if they are sort of trying to constantly capture whatever the zeitgeist is in terms of nostalgia, that would be the way that I'd go about it. I think that you'd have something there.
Yeah, sure. Well, they'll need about 10 rooms to accommodate all of the Atari Jaguar owners.
Now, you'd think that this hotel would be a dead ringer to put in Vegas. There's already a classic pinball museum. It's the former site of Classic Gaming Expo. And you'd be right. That's where they're going to put it. But they're also going to put some more locations in several other cities around the U.S. Basically, your big population hubs, Chicago and Phoenix and things like that. There's no word of when construction is planned to begin, but as soon as one of these gets up, I've been looking for an excuse to take a weekend trip to Vegas, of course, once coronavirus is over, and I will try and visit one of these at least once and report back on the experience.
Well, there goes my idea of subtlety. You don't do subtle in Vegas.
No, not at all.
Let me tell you, John, that some sports that I can't play and I don't watch. American football, NASCAR racing, and golf. Why am I telling you this? Because I've probably been exposed to more of these sports than any other simply because of video games. Mm-hmm. And if we focus in on golf in particular, I had this weird fascination with golf games across all generations of machines that I've owned. It was Leaderboard on the 8-bits. On the Amiga, it was PGA Tour and Nick Faldo's Golf. And then on the PC, I progressed to Lynx 386 and beyond. So I really did get into these games, never took the time to turn it on and watch it on the telly or go to a golf club or anything like that. There's just something about the sport that makes it work for me as a video game. And it's just as fascinating, I think, to play the game as to watch the technical evolution of the games. How realistic can my computer make that scenery look, and how quickly can it render the scene? That was the two big questions. It sounds incredibly nerdy, because it is, to have enjoyed, you know, waiting for a static scene to render with the trees and the clubhouse and the bunkers and all of that stuff. But I bet there are plenty of listeners out there that did exactly the same as me. I'd put money on it that there are lots of listeners who aren't into golf, but really enjoyed that side of things, that, you know, the golf video games and following the technology behind them. Does that describe you, John? Did you ever find yourself watching virtual fairways slowly develop on your screen?
Oh, yeah. I was a kid, I had no interest in golf whatsoever. Golf was something that my dad did that I thought was totally lame. But I did love a good golf game, for one thing, because it was one of the few video games that my dad would actually play with me. And I always cherished that time because, you know, video games were obviously the thing that I was into growing up. And it was cool to be able to sort of reel my dad into the scene in a limited way, at least.
Sure.
My first golf game was Leaderboard on the PC. In beautiful CGA graphics, Neil.
Oh, yeah, those purple fairways.
Right. I still feel like the game was 90% screen drawing and 10% gameplay. But to be honest, it never bothered me, because just like you, I enjoyed watching the computer draw the screens in the same way that people might enjoy watching Bob Ross paint a masterpiece on television. You know, you'd see the outlines pop up and you say, oh, well, I wonder what that's going to turn into. And it was neat. I thought it was cool. And since golf is a slower paced game anyway, I use that opportunity to plan out my next shot. You know, what am I going to hit? How many yards am I away? And so it really worked out well for me.
Yeah, figuring out which club to use next and get over those happy little trees and bunkers. Yeah. Well, I've brought this up this week because there is a new golf game for the Commodore 64, believe it or not. It's called Top Hole Golf by Matthew Clark, and it's a rather lovely looking game indeed. Only a preview has been released so far, but it looks like it's got support for four humans or computer players, and it has a very Leaderboard-esque feel to it. I don't think anyone will be surprised by how the game looks. It's that typical third-person view behind the golfer, looking down the fairway with the map to one side and the power meter to the other. But it does have some really nice graphical touches, like glistening water that twinkles away and spinning wind turbines in the background. So, you know, it looks like it's a pretty complete game, even though we're only at the preview stage yet. And it's always the control system which makes or breaks these golf games, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Just watching this, because I haven't actually had a chance to play this. I've only watched the preview on YouTube so far, but it does look like it's got a nice control system. So hopefully it all comes together well. But, you know, the beauty of these modern retro games is that you've got 30 years of games to look back on. So there are 30 years worth of golf games that have some got it right, some got it wrong, some use different types of power bars and different ways of controlling the golf swing. So there's lots of experience to draw on here to really nail this. And mm-hmm. I haven't seen anyone else tackle the golf game recently outside of, you know, something like Golf with Your Friends or Crazy Golf Games. I haven't seen anyone tackle a serious golf game on a retro system ever, really, since it was, you know, since back in the day. So I'm starting to waffle here, but what I'm really saying is that I'm oddly excited to go back and play an old school 8-bit golf game, which has had the opportunity to learn all of those lessons from older games and see if this might be able to dethrone Leaderboard as the king of the 8-bit golf games.
Yeah, I've got to say, I appreciate Mr. Clark keeping the traditional swing gauge in there. You know, there are several different power bars that you can look at. The Leaderboard one was, if I'm recalling it correctly, it was a straight line up and down, and then it would fill up with color and then go back down. And that was okay, but it wasn't ideal. Then you morphed into a C-shaped power gauge.
That's right.
And that was really the standard for a lot of games, and that is what this is used on Top Hole Golf. So I think that he's going the right way with this. I personally, you know, I'm a fan of having a longer gauge, like in Neo Turf Masters, that basically takes up, you know, the bigger portion of the screen.
One of your favorite games of all time.
Oh, yeah. I love Neo Turf Masters. I think that this is solid. I think the graphics look great. I appreciate the extra animation, the wind turbines spinning in the background and things like that. So this is definitely one I'm going to check out for sure.
Yeah, me too. We'll have to go around together. We'll work out how to play it remotely somehow against each other. So, keep an eye out for this one. Top Hole Golf on the C64. All links are in the show notes. And I'm really hoping that this one nails it to make some nice, enjoyable, slow-paced 8-bit gaming for a rainy afternoon.
Neil, we've been gifted several fantastic documentaries over the course of this past year. And we could be about to get another one. This is a new documentary called Arcade Dreams. And this is going to tell the story. Wait, I bet you've heard this before. The untold story of arcade games. Now, I will give them some credit. Instead of starting in the 70s, like every other arcade documentary ever made, they're going way, way back in time with their first episode and are focusing on the electromechanical games of the, you know, post-war period. So, you know, the 50s and the 60s. This is really an untapped area of arcade history. I can't remember seeing anything about it that's been professionally filmed. I have some books that go over, you know, various aspects of this scene. And I've seen some YouTube, you know, just kind of people walking around various museums and talking about things, but nothing that's been professionally filmed. And speaking of professionally filmed, the head cinematographer of this endeavor is none other than our own Bill Winters, a.k.a. Amiga Bill. That alone puts to rest any worries I had about the quality of the production. If Bill is involved, it's going to be top notch.
Oh, yeah. The Emmy award winning Amiga Bill. Fantastic.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So, Neil, what other aspects of arcade history do you think are in need of some attention?
Well, it's great to hear that they're covering those electromechanical machines. That's how you say it, isn't it? I think my favorite that I've had to, you know, got to actually play myself is a game called Grand Prix by Sega, which came out in 1969. And I came across a working example of this in the Flipper Pinball Museum in Budapest, of all places.
Wow.
So if you're ever in that area, it's well worth a visit. They've got a few others in there as well. And of course, all of the pinball machines. And I was surprised by just how well it played. You know, electromechanical games are just as playable, if not more, than some of those early, very limited games with a CRT. So definitely well worth a try. Mm-hmm. Another aspect I'd like to see covered, though, is the cabinet making itself, the different designs of the physical arcade machines and how those designs evolved over time. I'd love to look at those, you know, the lovely shape of the Nintendo cabinets of Mario and Popeye and Donkey Kong. Yeah. They've mm-hmm. got that really nice shape. I love the Nintendo ones. And the huge four-player cabinets like Gauntlet or NBA Jam Gauntlet, which I love so much that I based my own mini cabinet on that design. And you've got things like the Boombox that sits on top of the Skate or Die cabinet, the sit-down cabinets with multiple monitors. So much to look into on that side of things, you know. And then you've got the quirky machines like Sega's Time Traveler, which had the holographic dome over it, and Star Blade, which was a huge cabinet with a big holographic screen. Did you ever play Star Blade in the arcade, John?
No, I've never played Star Blade, but I've seen Time Traveler before. Yeah. I went to the Galloping Ghost in Chicago, which is a big retro arcade here in the States, and they have one of those. But Star Blade sounds amazing. I've never seen that one before.
You can get it on the 3DO and the PlayStation, but it's just not the same as sitting in that cabinet with this big wraparound holographic screen. It's like you're in Star Wars. It's incredible. Mm,
yeah, but, I'm totally with you though. When I buy arcade cabinets, I buy them for their shape. You know, I have a Mario Brothers cabinet, and Mario Brothers, of course, there's nothing special about the controls. It's easy to emulate. You can do it on anything, but I just love the way that Nintendo kind of has a forced 3D perspective with the flat bezel, and then you're looking down into the machine. It's a really beautiful design, and I also appreciate the old Universal cabinet. So I think that you're onto something there in that idea, Neil.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. So give me the cabinet makers episode of this series. Yeah. I'd love to see that. But let's get back on track. Tell me more about this Kickstarter, John.
Well, they've got a pretty high ask. It's going to take almost $100,000 to get this thing off the ground. Now, that's not saying it's not possible. Somebody I know just raised over $85,000 and all he made was a crappy book. Boom. So maybe this goal isn't so far off. Outside of the funding and the details about the first episode in the series, details are still pretty light. I guess they're going to see how much money they can raise. I'm not exactly sure what is holding it up, because as you know, with Kickstarter, if you don't meet your goal, then you don't get anything. But they're acting as if the first episode is already funded. It's a bit of a mystery. We don't know how many episodes there are going to be. We don't know exactly what's going to be covered in future installments. What I worry about is that once we get past this early period of fertile ground, all of the old tropes will be dug out again. You know, you're going to talk about Pong in the bar and having to change the name of Puckman and all that stuff. So, Neil, help us get over this hump. If you were on this production team, in what way do you think it would be best to approach the popular area of arcade machines, you know, that late 70s through mid 80s era in a fresh way?
Yeah, it has been covered so many times before. That's not to say it can't be done in a new and exciting way, especially with the cinematography of our good friend Amiga Bill. So I am rooting for this. And also, you said that they're kind of making out that the first episode's already done and dusted. Mm-hmm. You've kind of got to do that in a way. You've got to give confidence to people on Kickstarter to put their money forward. When I did the crappy book, as you called it, you know, I'd written 90% of the book first just to give mm-hmm. people the confidence that this thing will actually come to fruition. So,
sure.
You know, there's nothing too negative about that. But if I were to try and cover this, I would say give a man a suitcase full of cash, give him a warehouse, and what he'll do, he'll take that money. Let's call this guy Neil. And what Neil will do is he'll go out and save all of the dying, rotting arcade machines and lovingly restore them to create an arcade of saved machines. You could even call it a trash to treasure. And in rescuing them, he would pull together lots of trades, carpenters, graphic designers, electronics engineers, to show off all the skills needed to fix them up. And while fixing them up, talk about those games, who made them, why did they think this particular game would be popular, and why is it worth saving? Was it a success at the time? Was it a flop? Maybe find some old coins in the bottom of the cabinet. Maybe find a Garbage Pail Kid card stuffed in there, you know, see what history comes out of it. So the whole thing becomes more than an exercise in digging up old archive footage and adverts. It becomes a preservation effort. And it all happens in the present day, but it's telling the story of the machines and the lives that they touched. So I think that's how I would approach it.
Neil, that's beautiful. I mean, when I asked this question, I was not expecting an answer that I thought would actually be good. Not that, but that's an amazing pitch, because there's already a show that I think is on the BBC. We get it on Netflix here, and I think it's called The Antique Shop. And it's basically what you're describing, just with, you know, other, and sometimes they do have arcade machines and pinball machines, but it's mostly just a mishmash of old things. But that's what they do. They pull together people who are experts in all these different trades. And not only do they fix the things, but they're explaining the process of fixing them. They're giving you a history lesson at the same time. And you're getting to know the personalities of all these tradespeople, which is just as delightful. So, you know, I know that you're looking for a new cave, Neil. Maybe part of the cave can be set aside to launch this new venture. I'd love to see it.
Yeah, we do have a similar show called The Repair Shop.
The Repair Shop. That's what it's called. Sorry, right.
It's called over there as well. Okay.
Yeah, it's called The Repair Shop here too.
Yeah, so somebody turns up with like their grandfather's piece of, you know, antique furniture, and all the trades come together. They get all excited, they gather around it, and then they go away and fix it. Yeah.
And it's set in what I guess is called a living museum. So I guess this is a place that might be open to the public and they can walk in and see it. I've never investigated that, but I know reading the credits, that's what it says. So, you know, having that public exhibition part of it makes it, you know, an invaluable public service as well.
Yeah. Well, John, I might have some exciting news for you next week on the subject of the cave and those kind of ideas. Something has been verbally agreed, but until I actually get to sign some documents, I won't share any further. But
understood.
Watch this space, yeah.
So, like every Kickstarter, there's a million different tiers on this thing. If you just want the digital edition of the documentary, and again, we don't know how long or how many episodes it's going to be, it's going to run you $29. And if you want the Blu-ray, you can expect to shell out $49 plus shipping. I don't think that that's too out of line. I think that, you know, you're guaranteed at least one episode. As long as the series runs at least three or four, I think it's pretty reasonable. I mean, $29, you might think, well, that's a lot for a digital copy. But if you're getting, you know, 4 to 6 hours of content at the minimum, I think that's completely reasonable, especially from something.
Yeah.
Especially something that's an independent effort. He's not getting obviously any major studio backing. So,
yeah.
If you want to check out the trailer, it is available on the Kickstarter page. Just click on the link in our show subreddit.
So thank you for listening to This Week in Retro. Join our show subreddit and contribute your favorite stories from the world of retro.
Help us spread the word about the show by leaving us a review on your podcast app of choice, sharing our Facebook page, or just telling a retro-loving friend. See you next week for more up-to-date news
for out-of-date tech.